Okay, well, since everybody is quiet, we'll get started. I actually talked to the people who take care of these projectors, and they know about that it's dim and stuff like that, and they're thinking about replacing it. So I did what I could, except that it works better. Like that. Okay. Well, welcome to the second class session on perspectives in assistive technology, the best assistive technology course at Stanford. And today's going to be a little bit different than Tuesday. We're going to be talking about projects and things like that. But first of all, does anybody have any questions left over from Tuesday? A lot of material I presented, and I just wanted to know if it all sunk in, if you had any questions about it, or... Perfect. I was perfectly clear, obviously. A couple things. First of all, if anybody's here for the first time and missed Tuesday, an enrolled student, please get in touch with me because there's handouts and there's a... I think I've talked to all the students. If the first lecture is mandatory, so if you miss it, you have to review it on the internet and write a short summary. And for students who are working on projects, all the lectures are mandatory. So if you miss one, please review the audio and the PowerPoint slides. I will attempt to get the audio from each lecture on the website the day after the lecture. So you can check it out there, and there's a bunch of people who were in the class on Tuesday that hadn't yet enrolled on Access. So I encourage all the students to do that. And Professor Nelson got this course listed as one that satisfies the optional course requirement for the BSME degree, so this is not like a gym course or a music course. It's not an elective that you take above and beyond anything else. This actually can count toward your BS degree. A couple things about the lecture on Tuesday that I should have mentioned about wheelchairs in particular. There's basically two kinds of wheelchairs. There's the manual wheelchairs. Those are for people that have relative arm strength and able to propel the chair themselves. Those are called manual chairs. And for people who don't have that arm strength, there's chairs like these, but they used to be called electric chairs or electric wheelchairs, but the preferred term is powered wheelchairs, so please make note of that. And I did make a mistake when I was talking about service. There's this concept of service learning, and I think I said public service. Service learning is the incorporation of community members in coursework, and that's part of what we're doing in this class. And they actually have courses, a number of courses that fall into this category, including some very interesting ones where students work with prisoners and people in juvenile detention and things like that. So those are sort of interesting. And I want to go over a little bit more about why communication skills are important. And I should first say I'm probably not the best example of a person with perfect communication skills, but it is important. Maybe it's because I got a late start or something. But communication skills are important because what better way is there for people to realize how smart you are if you can't communicate that? How better would it be? What is a better way of communicating your worthiness for a job to somebody who interviews you? What's a better way of justifying your need for a raise, a good salary? And what's a better way of convincing the professor that you deserve an A in the class if you don't have good communication skills. So these are things you need to think about. So next Tuesday, we're going to have start off with a little bit of a discussion about some people you might know with disabilities and go through a bunch of pictures. And also we're going to have a student team who worked on a project over the summer present their project to you very briefly. And this will give you an example of how students work on projects and how successful they'll be. And so hopefully you can learn from that. And also, Debbie Kenny will be talking about, this is going to be your fourth year, about talking about consumers and occupational therapy, and actually going to have some real-life consumers and some assistive technology devices. Right? All right. Today we're going to talk a little bit about team formation and project selection, and then get into some of the project presentations. So, first, I want to talk about some people who can help you with your projects, and Debbie's one of them. Debbie has agreed to work with students like she did with last year, especially on the part that relates to individuals with disabilities. So her contact information was on the project handout sheet last time. And Doug Schwant, who you'll see later in the quarter, is a colleague of mine from the VA, and he's a mechanical engineer extraordinaire, and he can help you with the mechanical side of things. So these are people that you as working on a project, can call and get some information from and help you out on your project. Of course, the project team is responsible for working on the project, for completing it. These people will provide advice for you. Okay, you're probably, maybe a little bit challenged with the notion of forming a team and selecting a project. That's pretty daunting. But these are some issues I addressed in the slide. And obviously, some of them are pretty obvious, like the first one is that the team member should have a desire to work on the same project. That goes without saying. And, we thought that would be best if all the team members were either undergraduate or graduate. And we also thought it would be a good idea for team members who wanted to work on their project into the spring. Those people should all be on the same project. So it would be good to do that. And probably very important is the team skill level related to what the project's going to require. If you're interested in working on a project that has a lot of software involved in it and you don't have a background in software engineering, then that may not be the best selection for you. So you have to sort of pick something that's within your skill set. And I should mention at this point, too, that each project will have a different objective, depending on how many people are working on the project and what the project is and the challenge involved in it as well. But we'll all work together to make sure that you do something significant and beneficial. So don't worry about working on a project that seems very challenging or very elaborate and might take a long time. We'll scale it. We'll figure out how to scale it to fit, within the 10 weeks and the people that are working on it. Okay, and lastly, there's been people who have gone to, have actually researched forming teams and looking at people's personalities and matching teams, forming teams in that manner. But I think since we have such a small number of people working on projects, there's four with maybe two more people considering working on projects, that I don't think we have to go through that exercise. So the people should be able to work together as a team.
And if there's any ever any conflict within a team, please contact me, and I will do my best to resolve the issues.
Okay. Any questions on this material?
Okay, so I think we'll start with our project presentations, and I have Debbie listed on top, so if you want to start,
we'll have to change over the microphone.
Well, as you saw earlier, I've been working with this class now for this will be my fourth year. I'm an occupational therapist, been working as an occupational therapist for 20 years. Does anybody know what an occupational therapist does? A couple of you, good. an occupational therapist, most people know physical therapists. But occupational therapist is the occupation of daily living. What you need to do to get through each day, whether that's vocational, avocational, ADLs, that means activities of daily living, things that you need to do to take care of yourself, to be able to eat, to be able to bathe, to be able to clothe yourself and get where you need to go, to be able to handle your finances. So occupational therapists deal all in those areas with people who've had injuries or illness that could affect any of those areas of their daily living. And I've also been in medical research for, I'd say, probably 25 years. And I worked at the Rehab Research and Development Center over at VA for a lot of years, working with people like Eric Sableman and Dr. Jaffe, and developing different technologies being used for different populations. Currently, I'm working with at Stanford and doing research at Stanford that has to do with hand therapy, but I'm also an occupational therapist who works through the community college system with people who've had a stroke. And this is where this project that I'm proposing comes in. It was brought to me by several of my students that they would have problems using exercise devices such as foot cycles, or actually cycling on tricycles or recumbent bicycles, because they're having problems keeping their foot on the pedal. Now you say, why can't they use what's out there? We've got these kinds of things. We have toe clips. The problem with that is that a lot of these people don't have a good idea of where their limb is in space. They have problems with how much force and where that force is done through the leg. So maybe they're pushing down, and maybe the leg's going off to the side. So you need something that actually will keep them clipped in. We find through studies done at VA and other studies that cycling is a great activity. Not only does it increase heart rate up to what we would want to do to get your heart moving, as any aerobic exercise would be, but it's also important for developing the muscles that we actually use for regular gait, for walking. Okay, so it can have far-affecting beyond just cycling, just beyond fun, to gait itself. So it's an important thing. And not only with people who've had strokes is this a problem, but people with multiple sclerosis, sometimes people who've had diabetes because they have poor awareness of where their limb is and where their foot is, and their foot will tend to want to fall off. So this could be used for a lot of different populations and have a lot of impact. It could be dealt with in a lot of different ways. You know, could be, if you're coming from an electrical engineering perspective and that's your thing, there could be electrical engineering solutions as well as mechanical engineering. Don't discount how easy this seems. It's actually a complex problem. What I bring to you is, if you decide to take on this project, is that I've worked with teams over the years. I've worked the past 2 years mentoring different teams, not necessarily on my own projects, but on other projects. And I also have the clientele base, the people who will actually be end users who can actually help with the process. And we'll talk about that a little bit with my next lecture. People, questions about what I'm proposing? And to place their foot on the pedal. Think about this. Think if you, a lot of people who've had strokes, even if they're ambulatory, have balance problems. One side's tighter than the other. Maybe one side doesn't have as much muscle force as another. You're sitting on this bicycle seat. Just imagine this, this little bicycle seat, and you're having to balance, and you're having to try to get your foot onto a pedal. That's not easy. So there's a lot of different components that actually go into there. What's nice about pedaling is that even if you don't have your full strength to pedal all the way through the cycle, right, you can use your other foot to help out. But toe clips don't tend to work because even though some of the people can actually clip into a pedal, they can't get their foot out. So one of the things that a lot of my students are telling me is, sure, I can go and I can cycle, but I need somebody there at each end to help me get in and get out of my cycling device. And what we really strive for as occupational therapists, and I think physical therapists too, is that we want people to be as independent as possible. And I think this would be one way of helping them to be independent as possible, helping them cardiovascular, helping them with avocational skills. So we want them to be able to produce the force, produce it through the pedal in a way that makes sense to the what the task is. Both. You know, I have one gentleman who's up in Los Altos Hills who rides down to the Middlefield campus at Foothill on his recumbent bike, but it's still difficult for him. When we put him into his recumbent, it takes usually at least one other person plus about three bungee cords plus his toe clips to keep him onto the pedal. And he's highly motivated, and he's actually a fairly ambulatory individual. So he does it for both. Yeah. Other questions? Thank you.
I'm going to pass around the... The pink sign-up sheet is for students, so that's important for students to get credit for the class. The white sheet is for community members who haven't already signed up, and it's their first time, and they want to be on the announcement list. So I'll pass this around, too. And anybody who didn't get a handouts from Tuesday, I know William. I'll get you one, and you know, please see me after class as well. Okay, so next on our list is Mike Norell, and he has given us a number of projects to consider, and so Mike is here to briefly describe them to you, to the point of getting you interested. So put that in your pocket. Put that on the left side. So here's forward and backwards. And here's a laser pointer.
Oh, I like that. Well, first of all, I want to thank Professor Drew and Dave and staff for allowing me, giving me the opportunity to come in and show my project ideas. It's a great honor for me. I really like doing stuff like this. I really get enthusiastic when I start talking about this because I have been doing this for about 40 years now. And here's a little bit about myself here. A lot of my medical education is in the military. I was a hospital corpsman with the United States Navy. I was a field corpsman with the United States Marine Corps. Pretty much California educated with the emphasis on human biology, prosthetics, orthotics, human engineering. I do quite a few medical missions overseas. Currently, one of my mission groups is in India right now. In a month, I'll be in the Philippines, and we'll go to Bohol, and we'll see probably about 400 patients a day. And when we're done, we'll probably see about 1,400 patients. We do bring emergency room doctors with us, and physiatrists, and mostly Filipino nurses because they can speak the language. But it's pretty exhilarating when you go out on one of these, and the rewards are a lot more than money can buy. About my project ideas, these are what the goals I want. I want them very simple, so they're easily used by my patients. Very inexpensive, because nowadays, if it's not inexpensive, it's not going to sell. Marketability, is it worth even starting or purchasing? Practical, would it be used, and was it be used frequently? The liability, as we know, as Dave always will tell you too, safety always comes first with these people. So that's one of my primary objectives too. And of course, the engineering value is where you can further improve or advance a project that we're working on. And it can go a lot of different places. My first one will be a showering aid for amputees. As you can see here, this is pretty difficult to get over for an amputee. Also, getting into the shower, quite a bit difficult too. I'd like to have a device to where my patient can stand right here by the tub and somehow get into the tub very safely and be able to shower hands-free. I was thinking an airbag type thing. There could even be maybe a hoist on the top with some type of strapping to hold them in. If you need more ideas, I have tons of ideas for this too. But that would be my first problem, to see if some of my patients can get into a shower and shower hands-free and actually even watch their residual limit they have to. The second problem I have with a lot of my patients... Yes? Right. Well, you know, that's nice too, but we want him to be able to get into the shower and shower hands-free and be able to stand in it, because a lot of times they'll have to sit, a lot of times they'll have to put on their prosthesis with a bag over the top of it, and what's happening, they're really not cleaning themselves, it's just they're going through the process. And I'd just like to see if there's any way, if anybody can come up with something pretty creative, it could come from the bottom or it can come from the top. It's... Yes.
Such as transfer benches, and there's a device that does fit into the bathtub with hydraulic, it's like a bag system, and it will lower you or raise you into the bathtub.
I like that, yeah.
So I was just wondering where you wanted to go. Is this something you wanted to make something similar but cheaper?
Well, basically cheaper, yeah. The thing is that the key is cheaper, and if you can get something already in the shower to where they actually get in and step into it and they can go. I mean, I was thinking like an airbag, if there's any way you could do like an airbag. Of course, it'd have to have a wide base and everything.
Right.
But again, we can always talk about it if someone's interested in it, but
yeah.
I'm sure interested, and I know a lot of things that are out there now aren't as good as we like them to be.
Okay. That's what
you want to know. This one is a very tricky one,
yeah. And
I tell you what, I have a lot of patients that have to put on these compression stockings. And they give you these wire cages, they'll give you these slip-on aids, and I'll tell you what, they're not very good. In fact, I won't even carry them in my office, because it's almost like when you give them to them, they bring them back. They don't work. Now the compression on the foot and ankle down here is anywhere from 20 to 40 millimeters mercury of compression. So getting a flat sock around an L-shaped position of that degree is incredible. And of course... these socks, since they do have compression, you have to put them on flat. You can't roll them up and think you're going to pull them on, because once you fold it once, it doubles compression. You fold it twice, it quadruples the compression. So you really have to figure out a way of how how we can do this. A lot of this is non-compliance because I either have arthritic hands, obese person, hip replacement, or something to where they can't bend over. So it would have to be something to where a person could probably sit in a chair, minimal bending, and get a stocking on. The next one, improved goniometers. Okay, I've brought a lot of sample goniometers in here, and they all are... That might have been me, too. They all are in the back, and I have tons of them. Help yourself with all the tape measures, goniometers you can have. But this is what I have to measure my angles with, and I'd like to have it digital. Also, I would like to have a memory to where it can tell you range of motions. Pretty simple, but from doing a goniometer, we can actually make a chair that's filled with goniometers, and when a patient sits in it, you can actually measure contractures in the chair, possibly. I'm not sure if there's anything out there on the market like that.
Any Giles goniometers, yeah. There are electric goniometers, yeah, that are out there, and there is some electric goniometers that are currently out there, used mostly for hand therapy.
So they are digital goniometers out there.
They are digital, and they can measure range of motion, and they can be included into computers.
Good.
Yeah.
We used to break them.
Yeah. The Penny and Giles, the problem with it is because it's electric, that you have to, if there's any torsion to it, yeah, it can make things so that it's not reading.
Okay. But, yeah. You know. Oh, all right. That's good. Anyway, if we can make them cheaper,
yeah,
that's what I like. We want them comparable to this.
I should mention a part of the student's job with the CDC and what's already on the market and why that doesn't, you know, solve the need solve the need in reality. So there's got to be something wrong with what's out there in order to come up with a better design. Right.
Plus, I'd like to see these in every therapist office and every prosthetic office and every physiatrist office. And you don't see digital goniometers in their offices because they are a little bit more expensive than you want them to be. The next one is improve on a three-point pressure brace. As you know, a lot of these knee braces, osteoarthritis braces, they have to be long, they have to be bulky. And I was wondering if there's some way that we could put a strapping system on a knee to correct a medial lateral instability with maybe straps like this, to where when you came down on your foot, it would correct your knee. I don't know if there's anything out there that's available like that. I know I just found this on the internet at this flexible scoliosis brace, which I thought was fascinating. If there's some way that you can incorporate a strapping device on a knee to get rid of some of this bulk here and some of this bulk here, and maybe do it with a couple straps or a garment or something, I don't know. But I know that a lot of problems with my three-point pressure braces is they like to slip down, they're bulky, people complain of the weight, and so a lot of people aren't as compliant as I'd like them to be. Improve prosthetic pyramid system. Basically what this is here's your foot over here, and then you have a socket on the top here. Now the componentry in between here is very bulky, and it's not very streamlined, and usually I have a hard time putting a nice foot on a runner like this because I don't have any room between the socket and the foot to put adapters because, as you can see, the adapters are always kind of bulky. So if there's any other design that you guys can come up with to put between the socket and the foot for a prosthesis, the thing that's going on now is this pyramid system here and the screws. And as you adjust the screws, you can tilt the pyramid to adjust the prostheses. So that's the design we have now. I'm sure there's other things out there. The material we're using are titanium, steel, aluminum, and there's got to be some type of lighter material, I would think. Maybe a smaller material that you could get in that still could take a weight of 350-pound patient. Next one I'd like to see, and it might be out there, is a recording tape measure. And what I'd like to see with this is if you have to measure compression stockings or for body jackets or for things like that, what you basically got to do is you got to record one measurement, you got to stop, you got to record it, then you got to put the tape around again, you got to stop, then you record it. I was hoping that maybe that someone could put a tape measure that would work circumferentially, because it would have to be a fabric one that would record these measurements for you, either digitally or verbally, and have a memory of maybe 20 people. That way, when you measured, this thing would remember all your measurements, and then when you pushed a button or something, it would tell you the measurements or flash them up, and you could record them on your paper, therefore limiting the measuring, going back to the patient, coming back, going back, and then a lot of these measurements are inaccurate. And if you ever dealt with custom stockings, a lot of them go back. There's got to be a better way with tape measures. And I tell you, a lot of this little stuff I'm doing, I have an immediate distribution thing for it. So if it goes, we can distribute it right away, immediately. Weight distribution monitor. This was brought up to me by a physiatrist and a therapist. They're saying, you know what, the scale here idea is good, but is there any way that we can incorporate a scale into a balance so we can see how much weight my patients are putting on their left foot and how much patients are putting on their right foot when they're walking? Also, too, if we can get this done, I'd also like to put this on the bars so I can see how much pressure they're actually putting on their hands on the parallel bars when they're walking as well. I know that Dave brought up to me there is a mat called the gait right map, but I'd like something a little better than that. I'd want digital readings on this, and I'd want numbers and everything else. Something a lot more expensive.
Yeah, there's horse plates, and they're expensive,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. But if there's any way we could do this cheap, like the nice thing is a balance. If someone's standing, I want to know if they have a stroke. Are they putting enough weight on that side? If they're not, then my therapist can go in and say, you need to put more weight on that side. Or if they're walking in parallel bars, are they putting them on their hands? Or are they putting them on their feet? And something cheap. You know, we could start with a scale that's a balance, but then, you know, there's a lot of things that can go from there.
There is some pressure sensor technology out there that could be brought to bear on this project.
Yeah, and then maybe translated to numbers, possibly.
Absolutely.
Shock-absorbing braces. Okay, I have quite a few polio patients out there still, and, of course, a lot of the technology with polio bracing is you got to bring that brace up here an inch and a half out of the groin or an inch out of the groin for it to have the best lever possible to be effective and have less pressure on the patient's leg completely. Well, what I'm finding out was since these things have to go up so high and the knees are always locked, that every time they come down on this, they come down pretty hard, and that transmits all that pressure back up into their groin. I've got some spring-loaded crutches that I put together a few years ago and marketed. In fact, I saw Yao Ming wearing one of them the other day. But if there's somehow I can incorporate a spring or a dampener on this, either on the top or on the bottom, to, as they come down on this, to displace that pressure, you know, they might be able to do a lot more in their braces than, you know, transfer and some of the things they're doing.
There are people now looking at that as a way of recharging your iPod by using that energy instead of just dissipating it, generating electricity with it. So that's double purpose.
That's right. So anyway, again, it's definitely been my pleasure to come out here. You know, I love doing stuff like this. My hair's on fire is what I tell everybody. And if anybody has questions, you know, Dave showed you a couple resource people. I would love to be a resource person for anybody who wants me to be. Again, I've been doing this for 40 years. I go out to the Philippines and do medical missions and everything else. And when I have time, I play 250 softball games a year, too. Thank you very much.
Am I not injured yet?
Motrin. Good. Motrin and good foot orthotics. Thank you, Dave. Also, too,
again, tape measure going on there's in the back. Take as many as you want to, whatever.
Okay, I should mention that all the presenters will be sticking around later on, so you're encouraged to talk to them, see what they brought, and get a little bit better feel about what the projects are. This is just to sort of tempt you and get you the basic overview of these projects, and there's a lot more information that you need to get from the people who are suggesting these projects. So, are you next, Bob?
On your list.
Okay.
And here's your pointer and
pointer and laser pointer and your
perfect. Perfect. Okay, well, thanks. This is something completely different, which is in terms of the work that's being done. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Bob Bauer, and Steve Cousins would have been here, but he broke his hand, and so he's got other problems right now, and was just operated on a Monday. He's the CEO of Willa Garage, and Steve and I have worked together for a number of years. Willa Garage is a new effort that started about 3 years ago in the area of robotics, where the big bet is that personal robots are going to become a huge part of our lives, especially with our society aging as it is. And in Europe and in Asia, it's even worse than here in the U.S., though we all talk about the baby boomers here. And the idea is to spur the development of a new platform which puts together sensors and actuators with computation in order to get robotics to really take off. So the purpose of Willa Garage is to produce an open source platform in the same sense that computers like Linux is the software platform for computing these days, and there are hardware platforms due to standards as well. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And the idea here is that how do we start to spur the possibility of using robots to help the disabled, people with disabilities? I learned how to last week. People with disabilities, and also the elderly who increasingly are disabled, actually, in their ability when they need assistance in order to live in an unassisted living situation. So let me just tell you a few things about that. Let's see. Here we go. So some of the things that people with disabilities might need involve things like carrying objects, remembering where things are, retrieving items, preparing food, cleaning up around themselves. Moving around the house itself can be very difficult sometimes. And so just things that we take for granted in our everyday lives around dishes and cleaning up and cooking and just organizing things are things that robots could, in fact, help with. There have been lots of attempts to have personal robots, mainly in Asia. These are just a few pictures reassembled. The problem with all of these devices, in order, not only are they expensive, but the biggest problems with many of these is that anytime you do a project, like here in class, you have to start by building the required hardware, figure out what software is necessary to support just the simple movement of getting a device to do what you want it to do by giving a control mechanism from a computer to through a wire to a motor and a controller. All of that needs to be in the operating system of the robot and is something that Willa Garage is developing for free and giving away to anybody that wants to start a company anywhere in the world at no cost, in the same way that Linux is available to anyone. As you might not be aware, but not be surprised either, people like Microsoft are building robot operating systems, which of course won't be available or have the open source community developing and helping with it. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that, tell you a little bit about how the purpose is that from the time that the project starts, any project could advance immediately because there already is the mechanisms to just think about the applications and to program by taking stacks of code that have already been pre-assembled that tell you to move an arm from this point to this point and the robot will do it. That's something that's actually very complicated and involves all kinds of things around vision and perception, and I'll show you some of that. All of that being already done for you is sort of what we're hoping to be able to do. And I'll talk to you about what would be available if you choose to do this project. So one way to look at it is the hardware, the software, and the applications to be explored. And the idea is to just focus on the applications. And the belief is that the industry and the only way to make it inexpensive and to launch a personal robotics industry is to make all the stuff underneath it standardized. Willow does two things, a robot operating system called ROS. And the first iteration of Personal Robot 1 was actually done here at Stanford as part of the STAIRS project in this building. Stanford AI robot, maybe? I don't know. I made that up. I don't remember. Or it could be assistive intelligent robot. Anyway, it's a personal robot project here. And the two graduate students who built PR1 left their graduate studies in the great tradition of Stanford, and joined Willow Garage to build PR2, which currently is being made, and 25 of them are currently being assembled. 10 of them will be given away to universities around the country in order for experimentation to occur. Let me tell you a little bit about what those capabilities are. I probably, because of time, won't show you. I have videos. Every one of these still pictures has a video on YouTube behind it that we can talk about, and I'll be up here later if you want to see it, or you can go look online yourself. This is the robot that is PR2 with laser devices and all kinds of things. The latest milestone that it achieved was to be able to navigate autonomously for a for 26 miles as if it were doing a marathon, with people walking all around it during that time. It took about 6 days. It can plug itself in to recharge its batteries. That's one of the big challenges of a robot, batteries, as you can imagine, just like it is for iPods. And it can also open doors. So it had to open doors, it had to navigate 26 miles and plug itself in 10 times, which it did. The thing that's interesting about it is that it's about the size of a person. It can go up and down, and its arms are completely compliant in almost any range of motion. The other one I wanted to tell you about, which is an offspring, because it's modular, as we'll describe, there's another robot, which is currently being manufactured right now, about 250 of them, which are just parts off of the PR2. And it's being used, it's a little hard to see in this picture. Well, it's called Texas because the engineer, first name is Dallas. And think of it as Skype, a Skype video call on a mobile foot, which is taken off of the PR2, that can go around. And the thing is, today it's just a telepresence device, which there's a whole story I could tell you later about how it's really changed things from being in conference rooms to where he literally moves around the facility and goes into conference rooms or go and talk to people as if he were there, and it really changed. Well, just like you're all familiar with the way social media and virtual reality have helped, this really has transformed things. And the reason that's interesting, I think, for this class in particular, is that this device, we have plenty of these. We don't have so many PR2s right now because they're still being assembled. And it has no manipulation capabilities currently because of the way it was sort of originally designed. So it's very robust. It will be relatively inexpensive. When we talk about robots, by the way, some of us believe that the threshold is the cost of a car rather than the cost of a device, because people who get disabled won't be able to, and old, give away their cars and they stop driving. And they're sort of used to spending like $15,000 plus or minus for a car.
So you can have a robot for clunker program.
There you go. Right. And this robot, and I'll talk to you about a lot more about various things if you're interested in this, because this is one where, what kind of manipulation would I add to this kind of a device? And there are arms that are available of all sorts for robots. The idea is that that all of these robot pieces that are in hardware and software are completely modular, so that it's only like the only real activity here is, well, what would you do to manipulate? So the project that you heard about in last class, where the wheelchair had the device that allowed you to push the elevator button off of the wheelchair, just think about that. I mean, what if they were just simply something that could raise and lower itself and just push something? Maybe that's something of value, right? And yet all of the other activity occurs. And the other thing is, the other reason I think this is exciting is because it's not autonomous, which is a very difficult problem, to have robots respond to voice commands and do things. Rather, the other people that would buy this is, instead of your elder parent or grandparent moving in with you, you get to be remote at your home. You get a call and they say, gosh, I dropped something on the floor, can you pick it up for me? And you go and you teleoperate it remotely, pick it up, put it back in, and all of that could be done. Right, and so therefore it becomes a much simpler device, and this will come down in cost to be much cheaper than $15,000, by the way, this kind of a device. Again, there are videos behind all of these. These are the things that are in the stack that already exist that are easily and software addressable through the device in terms of visualizing, navigating, planning the way an arm might, a manipulation might move. You'll see in the videos today there's just a grabber there's not a full hand. There's just a grabber with pressure sensors that works very well. And all these other things. Yes, I'm sorry. Question.
Is this particularly advantageous for this technology to compartmentalize
between a robot as opposed
to like this thing? Like, I don't know, maybe like you get like this technology to invest in like a door to connect open stuff as opposed to like having a robot to do something.
Yeah, it could be.
Is there like a particular advantage
to having a robot? Well, that's an interesting idea. You know, from a technology point of view, it's sort of agnostic to either of those things. I didn't say anything about our backgrounds, but Steve and I both got our PhDs here at Stanford, different generations, but mine was in electrical engineering and his was in computer science. I think you could do that, but the idea here is that the mobility that you get from having a mobile device in any kind of a living system where people live together, by the way, you could also have one of these on a floor that gets shared by a number of people. So it sort of manipulates into a room and helps people. So one nurse could handle entire areas, right? And that's the other way to do it. Okay. So that's all we'll talk about. There's also, just so you know, there's a simulator that allows for 2D and 3D simulation, which is probably the way their project would be tested rather than on the device itself.
Oh, that's good.
So we can talk about that more later. Thank you.
Okay.
I get too excited.
Well, you're just a passionate person. That's all. Okay. All right. Who's next? Oh, okay. Okay, there's you, right there.
Left power.
We're right in there.
And this is forward.
Okay. All right, you can hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Eric Sableman, and I have a doctorate from Stanford as well in bioengineering 25 years before there was a department of bioengineering here. And I worked with Debbie and with Dave for 20 years about at the VA, developing, among other things, a wearable computerized motion analysis system. It's basically the granddaddy of your Wii controller, so it has sensors in it for doing the same kind of thing. Some of the people we tested were patients with Parkinson's disease. And when I left the VA, I went to Kaiser to work on actually treating those patients. So the students that I used to deal with at Stanford and at the VA, I would always tell them they need to get some real clinical experience. Well, now I'm having to walk the talk. I'm part of the team that actually implants these deep brain stimulators into patients to control abnormal signals in the brain. Basically, you get a fault in your brain that causes an abnormal feedback loop, and it can generate a number of serious difficulties. Some of those difficulties I've marked in red because those are all motor disorders. It's beginning to be used for things like post-stroke pain and for psychiatric disorders like depression. It's basically for any disorder in which you can find a very localized cause so that you can reset the clock that's running at the wrong rate. It's like a pacemaker for the brain. And it's the standard of care for the last 10 years for Parkinson's disease when the medications are no longer effective. So it's quite a popular treatment. It works. I'm not going to go into great detail. I could give you a whole slideshow just on that. But one of the recent developments that Medtronic has put on the market is a rechargeable device. Let me say a little bit more about the difficulty of doing this, just to give you some background information. My job exists because of the need to have this kind of submillimeter accuracy, that the electrode only affects a few millimeters around the contacts. And this is down deep in the brain. So you've got to locate it correctly. And there's a whole series of steps that we go through at Kaiser. There's similar physicians here at Stanford Medical Center use a somewhat different technique. And they basically jump from here down to here
And we do a few more steps to make sure that it actually turns out to go in the right place. So there's the electrode being stuck down into the brain. You record what's happening down there to make sure you have neurons that are part of that abnormal feedback system. And then you put in a permanent electrode. And the permanent electrode looks a little bit like this. We provide the programmer, the person who's going to set the rate and which of these four contacts are activated. I don't like laser pointers. I'm going to wave my hands at the thing. And we show where we've detected neurons that connect to your leg or to your arm or to your face. We basically don't want to do anything to your face. We can make your face jump around if we put stimuli there. But if the symptoms are worse in the arm, then we want to locate the contacts near the arm. And if your symptoms are worse in the leg, we can put the contacts down at the leg. We can turn them on to various voltages. And this is the kind of information that I provide to the person who's doing the programming, who's trying to guess which of these things, which contact and what voltage and what rate are needed to relieve the symptoms. So that's the area that the programmer needs to know about, and the top two electrodes here are not going to be as effective. And then it generates these cyclic pulses continuously. The rechargeable device is now a new thing. This is an X-ray, one of the non-rechargeable one. It has a fairly big battery in there that's going to last from 3 to 7 years. The rechargeable device has to be recharged, obviously. The battery is going to last 9 years, but it has to be recharged from every other day or 3 times a week, something like this, for ideally only half an hour a day, or half an hour per charge. But the problem in recharging it is you have to couple energy through the skin to the pickup coil that's located in the pulse generator. And that coupling is the cause of the problem that we're going to ask students to solve. This is from the instructions on the new device that Medtronic has put on the market. Since there's nobody here from Medtronic, okay. Medtronic has tried to put this on the market quick because St. Jude Medical was coming out with the same thing. Both of them have had rechargeable devices for lower back pain, spinal stimulators, okay? And so they've basically taken the same hardware and said, okay, we're going to use it for, they renamed it, of course, and so it looked like it's new. But it's the same stuff, and they're going to use it for these people with motion disorders. And the problems arise because the recharge depends on the patient being able to couple the energy into the battery. The batteries themselves have some problems in that if you let them completely discharge twice, they die, and the thing has to be surgically removed and replaced. That's one of the technical faults. Okay. The other technical fault is that they either never looked at the patient population with motor disorders to see how easy it was for them to put the sensing or the recharging coil in the right place. And it turns out to be very difficult. It's much worse than the problems that the people with pain in their lower back have. Even so, those people tend to not wear the vest that's provided, and instead they'll sit down in a chair and they'll drape the recharging coil over their shoulder or something like that, because it's just too much trouble to put this vest on and off. And I'll show you, there's a picture of it here. Medtronic has agreed to do some funding of this. They know it's a problem. And they're going to provide the vest, which looks like this. The recharging coil is right there. It's actually recharged twice. You charge an internal battery, so now you can walk around wearing this vest, and the battery then recharges the device that's implanted. So there's multiple steps here. I have a fairly thick manual on programming the thing, but there's almost nothing. There's nothing on the website. This picture comes from one of their physician instruction slideshows. So they haven't really provided very much information to the end user on how to do this, on how to couple the belt around your waist, how to strap it over here, how to rotate this little thing around so it's facing the right direction. So the basic problem is that the more motor disorders you have, the more difficulty you're going to the more you need it, the more difficulty you're going to have doing it. They were expecting to sell about half and half rechargeable and primary cell batteries. Based on our experience, we aren't going to prescribe those. We're going to implant maybe 10% rechargeables and continue implanting most of the rest of them non-rechargeables just because the patients can't deal with it. So that's the motivation for Medtronic to try to improve this recharging system. And the reports that we have, and we'll try to provide some videotaped interviews with some of the patients who actually have these, the reports are that instead of half an hour, it takes them 2 hours to do the recharging just because it slips off the location it's supposed to be or it never was properly coupled to start with. So that's our problem we'd like you to solve, and it's you know, a real-world problem, and it's the sort of thing that a high-tech company somehow lets slip, you know, the fact that the end users have to use their product.
Thank you, Eric.
Okay, who's next on the list? Tansy is next, right? Need to connect to. Okay.
My name is Tansy Brook. I'm the communications director for a company called NeuroSky, Brain to Computer Interface Technologies. I want to first of all thank you all for inviting me here today and for considering our company for this project, and thank the professor as well. We have kind of a different situation in that we are not experts in this area. We know there's a lot of potential in this for applications in the assistive technology area for our company, but we're really interested in exploring those and see kind of what the different applications might be. So just a little bit of background on our company. We have a technology that is basically a simplified version of a traditional EEG. We use a single sensor that rests on the forehead and a ground and reference point on the ear. Part of the reason we use a single sensor is because that way we can use a dry sensor and we can put it on the forehead, so we don't have to, it makes it a lot more user-friendly. And another benefit is it makes it really cost-effective. Our approach is taking something that has traditionally been really bulky and difficult to use and trying to make it, again, as easy, affordable, and in a lot of cases, fun as possible. So you can see kind of the traditional approach to EEGs in the bottom left there, and a gentleman wearing our headset on the right. So a couple of different things about our company. We have a core biosensor technology company, and again, we have focused on taking a technology that has been in the medical field for a number of years and building it from the ground up to be cost-effective and user-friendly so that it can be applied to a number of different industries. We specialize in the technology. We focus on the hardware, typically at a chip level, and then work with partners to apply the technology to their industries. So we work with the toy industry. You may be familiar with the Mattel MyFlex. It's a toy that was the hottest toy this Christmas, where you basically are levitating a ball through an obstacle course depending on your levels of concentration. So the more you focus, the higher the ball levitates. We work with Mattel on that because they're experts in the toy industry, and they can figure out the best creative ways to apply it to the toy industry. We work with a number of different groups. We work with
with video game developer Square Enix, who's created Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest. A number of different groups who do more serious games, like the Serious Games Institute, and a group called Neurocog. And they've created applications where they can take the technology and help do different types of therapy. So for one example is, I don't know if you're familiar with the biofeedback clinics that are getting more popular for children who have ADD, ADHD, where you go into a clinic, they put on a full medical device, so more comprehensive than what we have, and you go through a number of different exercises learning how to intentionally concentrate and to relax. So our technology isn't a replacement for that, but we have a partner that's created an application where they can take one of our headsets and a PC, go home, and play this game, and it reinforces all those behaviors because it's like exercising your brain. The more you do it, the more effective the treatment is, and they found that they can either lower or completely get rid of medication in a lot of cases. So that's kind of a more serious application. Another application kind of in that realm is we have a partner, Dr. Fatouhi, who's from Johns Hopkins and Harvard, who specializes in preventing Alzheimer's. So he's working with a game publisher to create a game where you play it on a Nintendo DS, and you go through a number of different games where you exercise different parts of your memory. Whether you're trying to remember people at a party or you're trying to go shopping, you go through these different activities, and our technology tracks your levels of concentration. And so it can give you feedback on what areas you had to concentrate harder on, so that you have that feedback knowing that those are things that you need to look into practicing more. So a couple different applications. We also have a number of areas that we're looking into with kind of the safety industry, which is more down the line. We're working with some leading auto manufacturers who are interested in putting our technology in cars. So say one night you're driving home late and you start kind of dozing off. Having a car that can recognize that and either, you know, sound an alarm, turn on your radio, you know, if it's a different type of application, ring your cell phone, and just kind of let you know that you're going into that state. Because we've made it really cost-effective and really user-friendly, it makes it very easy to adapt to a number of different industries, whereas in the past, it was pretty much limited to the medical industry because of cost and usability issues. So this is kind of a basic version of how our technology works. What it does is it takes a couple second calibration to identify your brain waves, 3 or 4 seconds when you first put the headset on. And then it starts sensing your brain wave pattern. So it's actually, with our technology, we're looking for specific patterns of brain waves that represent specific things. So the two algorithms that we currently have available are called attention and meditation. Attention is similar to concentration, meditation is similar to relaxation. And the interesting thing about it, one thing that's interesting about attention meditation is you can do them separately or you can do them together. So they're similar to like a Venn diagram. One thing that we found with some of the other research projects we're doing with the Olympic archery team is that we found that the most proficient archers, those who are the best at their skill, tend to have high levels of both attention and meditation when they perform. So basically what we found is that there is a technical explanation for what athletes commonly refer to as being in the zone. So they're very focused, but they're also very relaxed. And some of our research department is working with them on doing some different sports training with that. So it's kind of something interesting that's come up. So then, of course, we have the extraction. We take out the brainwave patterns, and we do processing on board. There's actually a chip that's in the headset that we have that does a majority of the processing. One of the things that we do is we do filtering on two levels, which is one of the most difficult things with using a traditional EEG device is that they're extremely sensitive. Even overhead lights are noise that can interfere with getting a clear signal. So we have worked really hard on taking out both environmental noise and then also internal noise. So things like eye blinks, muscle movement. We do a lot of filtering on that chip to remove all that. And then we can do a couple of different things. We can apply our algorithms and turn that information into commands for a device. So, for example, the Mattel MindFlex, where you're levitating a ball because they're using that attention command, where you're focusing. The more effectively you focus, the higher the ball raises. Or another application is a number of researchers and companies as well are exploring just the broad brainwave data. So in addition to the two algorithms that we currently have developed, there's a lot of researchers who are just interested in that raw brainwave data. And they can apply that in a number of different ways, whether it's sleep studies or applying their own algorithms or a number of other things. So like I said, this is typically how we work with partners is we provide them with a component-level technology. We have an ASIC chip. But recently what we've done is released the NeuroSky Mindset, which is a headset that has our technology in it. Again, it has that single sensor and the ground and reference point on the ear. And actually what we've also done is made the SDK free, available to everybody, because we've had a number of people that have contacted us, specifically in a number of different areas, such as cerebral palsy, multiple sclerosis, Locked-in syndrome, ALS. And we get a lot of questions from people saying, can you help my loved one? Because usually a lot of time it's somebody who has somewhat of sometimes they have a background in engineering or programming, and sometimes they don't. So one of the reasons we opened up the SDK is because, as I said, we're a technology provider. We're not experts in all of these areas that you would have to be in order to apply the technology to this. So one of the things I wanted to tell you, a couple of different things, just feedback-wise, that we've gotten about what people are using the technology for currently. We do have a gentleman who does have severe cerebral palsy, and we have a game that comes with our with the headset, where you can levitate objects by concentrating, by relaxing, or you can light them on fire by, you know, concentrating, which is very popular, evidently. Go figure. But anyway, so his mother was really excited because she said, you know, I got this game for him and he can play it. You know, there aren't a lot of other games. Now, keep in mind, you still have the mouse and you still have directional control with the mouse keys, but she could kind of play it with him. And so, you know, he was really excited about that because it was a way that he can kind of have fun and interact. Another example like I said before, is, you know, the use of, for kids who have ADD, ADHD, there's also been some interesting research that's being done internally, well, not internally, but with partners at the university level in autism and a number of other areas. There's a local doctor that sent us some reviews, just some of her experiences, and said that she had strokes when she was young, like 10 or 20 years ago. And she has tremors, constant tremors, and that by using the technology, in this case in the toy form, she bought one of the toys that one of our partners made, she was able to stop the tremors because so she could relax. And then there was another one of her patients who had chronic movement disorder and also sensitivity to light. And they were, after practicing with the technology for a little while, they were able to bring up the lights and the patient wasn't bothered by it. So those are just kind of anecdotal, some of her experiences. So some quick limitations to using the technology. Kind of the natural application that people come to us with is for people, like I said, who have severe cerebral palsy or Locked-in syndrome. And realistically, for a lot of those people, this isn't the best solution. A lot of the times, those people will use things like blinks to communicate. In a lot of instances, that's more effective. It makes more sense. It's a lot easier to blink than it is to concentrate on something. The other thing is that, tying into that, is that the information you're getting is analog. Brainwaves are analog. They're not digital, so it's not like an on and off command. You have a range between like 1 and 100, and you can set the threshold. So, for example, with the headset that we have, it's a higher number as compared to the toys that were created. The toys that were created, we wanted them to be pretty easy for kids to use because kids don't like them, they get bored and don't play with them anymore. So the threshold was set lower. So you can engage it at a different point, but again, it's not like a 1 and a 0 and on and an off. It's a range. Another thing is that a lot of time when people first start, they tend to be better at attention or meditation. With practice, we found you can get better at both. But a lot of the time, it does take some practice. So it's not kind of an instant solution. It usually takes, you know, I'd say at least 20 minutes or so before people kind of get that aha. So the thing that we were thinking about that seems the most natural adaptation, although we are ecstatic to hear and see any ideas that anybody else has, was the situation where the blinking isn't a better option for people who have locked-in syndrome, where perhaps it makes sense for them to have an interface where they can concentrate on an object and communicate in, maybe in a limited way, and it's a more cheap and cost-effective option. Again, the headsets that we have right now are $200, and then they work with any PC. So you could have that sent at home with somebody, and then they have a way that they can kind of communicate. So that's another part of that, I think, that would be key is the interface. So it's not just, you know, having the headset and setting it up that way. Part of it, I think, is thinking about usability and thinking about, okay, maybe using something like word completion. If you're not going to go through an entire alphabet, you can kind of divide it up into, I don't know, vowels and consonants and go through. And then when people get close to a word or something like that, that maybe the program could help kind of finish the words or something like that. That's just kind of the most common one that we've come up with. But again, you know, we're excited to see what people who have more experience in this area and more expertise see as a potential for the technology. Because again, we really see that there's an application there. We're just not quite sure what it is. So, thank you.
Thanks so much, Tansy. Our final pair, Lilia and Joseph,
they're from the Webster House.
And that's a facility that is an assisted living center. So they're going to be talking about their facility and some of the needs of their residents.
Good afternoon. My name is Liliana Kashuba. I am the Director of Community Relations for a company called Webster House. I will be just giving you a briefly description or background about Webster House, and then Joseph, who is our wellness nurse, he will be talking about different ideas for the assistive technology. Webster House is owned and managed by Sunrise Senior Living. We are a continuing care retirement community for seniors. This community has 36 units, apartments, and currently we have 37 residents living with us. It's mainly for residents, and they can live independently in their own apartment. But the reality is that these residents, they develop needs in the future, and we do have residents and they need assisted living services. Sunrise, we are owned and managed by Sunrise Senior Living. Sunrise Senior Living has about 400 communities around the country. So Webster House mainly is for residents and they can live independently, but we do provide assisted living services as well. So now I'm going to introduce to Joseph to give you some ideas on what the challenges that our residents are facing on a daily basis.
So we were presented with Willow Garage and the robotics part as far as, and I'm really new to this, so I'm not really wasn't sure what to expect, but with the robotics part of it, right now we kind of have a gray area. Sunrise Senior Living is an assisted living community that focuses on that. We have specialized areas as far as dementia care, but Webster House is unique in that we focus mainly on independent living. The gray area where we're having difficulty with is residents who develop cognitive impairments. In assisted living, you have locked doors. You have, after a certain time, you have to have a code to get out. Webster House doesn't have that. We can have that by law. So what we need is somewhat of a guidance for residents who have a cognitive impairment and are starting to develop into dementia-like symptoms or Alzheimer's-like symptoms. And what we need is some type of guidance for them. Oftentimes, we'll have a resident who's, we have five stories. One of the residents recently lived on the fifth floor. Knew what time dinner was, knew what was for dinner, picked out her menu, goes down to dinner and ends up on the fourth floor in another residence room doing the dishes. And that's a gray area. If we can prevent that, we could keep that resident for another 2 years. And it also, it's not only about retaining them, it's about quality of life. Initially, when we have that problem, we look and say, I assess them and say, okay, their quality of life has greatly diminished because, one, they're obviously a safety hazard to themselves. By chance, the resident wandered into the fourth floor into a different room. We have open stairwells. We have open pools. The doors open automatically to get outside. So what we are looking for, and in collaboration with Willow Garage, was almost a personal assistant. Now, prices for a one-on-one aid, home health aid, things like that, are very high, especially if in the case it's in the case where somebody just needs to be escorted to the dining room. They have perfect gait, no walking impairments, nothing except the fact that they don't know where it is. Things like that would be a great help because we wouldn't have the cost increase for that resident because, again, although it is an upscale living community, I think one of the reasons why they have a lot of money is because they're penny pinchers and they don't want to spend any money on anything. So we have a resident who can't get to the dining room. I call their family and let them know, and they say, well, they'll make it there. Or they'll say, well, can you guys escort them? And the answer is we always can't because we do have other things that we need to spend time on. That is a priority, but at the same time, that's a staffing issue, and that costs money, and then we can't do it, which means we may have to send them elsewhere. My goal is to keep their quality of life high, and it presents two issues, not only getting to dinner, but the safety issue, the open stairwells, the open pool, things like that. So once a resident becomes a wanderer or tends to elope, that's where we want to catch and have, whether it be, I'm not really sure what, I'm just throwing out the problem and hoping that you guys could come up with the answer. There's other things on the paper, but that was the one I wanted to focus on. The other one I wanted to focus on, and I don't know if any product exists, was fall awareness. Again, independent living. There's clearly residents we have who need help, but the loss of independence in seniors, I think it's hard to understand unless you're there or you are them, because they will fight you until the end, until they cannot do anything by themselves, to where their family has to come in, or we have to come in and say, kind but firm, we are going to help you, no matter the cost. Because the issue is, they will say no no matter what. There's some residents who will say, please do, and other residents who should have received help 5 years ago, and they still have not, because the loss of independence is too much for them. So the problem is, residents who are a fall risk, we do have transferring services. We do, myself, a lot of our team members go in and transfer them to places they need to go with somebody by them because they are a fall risk. But when they're taking showers, they don't want anybody there. And it poses a problem for us, which is what we can handle as far as can we have somebody there in the case that if they are alone, and they do fall, can somebody be notified? Because, again, I told you we're independent living, so somebody falls right now at Webster House on the fourth floor in an independent room and isn't wearing their call button or their pendant and can't get to a pool cord, we will not know until we go into that room. And as independent living, we don't check do rounds every hour. You know, we need to know that they fell. We need to know if they hit their head. We need to be there in a matter of minutes. And that's the problem. We need a device that would be able to be with the resident, have them fall, and live independently if they were to fall, and notifies the... We have a central area where we have care managers and nurses have pagers. We need to be able to know that they fell without us having somebody stand in there the entire time. So those are the two problems, or those are the main problems that we're facing right now, and you know, if you could help us out, that'd be great.
Thank you, Joe.
Sure.
Well, I have one more project that I want to show, and I want to allude to a couple others, but I want to get this in before everybody leaves. This is a project with a professor emeritus here at Stanford, and he lives across from Stanford Shopping Center in a very nice facility there with his wife. And he's sort of old, and he has a few impairments, but his mind is very active. And he has some ideas of things that will help himself, and he's actually worked with with some of my colleagues in prototyping some of this stuff, but it's a good point now to take that prototype and develop it as a student project. And Professor Kane, this is Professor Kane here. He didn't understand what that he wanted to, that he should talk now.
Could you demonstrate your device for us?
Yes.
So he has a couple of canes that are sort of articulated, and the top part is sort of angled as like a forearm type of support, and then there's a vertical element that provides contact to the ground. And so that really helps him because he doesn't really need a walker. And a walker is a lot bulkier than a couple of these canes are. Now, I've seen on the market some crutches that have a horizontal element that the forearm rests on and then a vertical element for the cane. But this is a little bit different, and I haven't seen anything really like this before. This is a crude prototype. Made out of PVC tubing, and it's our hope that Student Project can take this to the next step and come up with something a little bit more refined and test it with him. And we actually have some money to do this, so I'd really like to have a student team, you know, work on this this year. He's a local guy. He's sort of a character in the best sense of the word, and I think it'll be a very worthwhile project for both the student team and for him as well. So please consider this. This is listed under Kane's Kane.
Quick explanation. So he's using these extensions on his arm for
to support the cane instead of having one grip. It's sort of, you know, gripping him around the forearm, so it provides that extra extra connection to his body.
So it's actually, we can't see it here. But
yeah.
So it's actually connected to him up there.
Right. Yeah. It's probably not. It hasn't been fabricated that way,
right.
But that's the idea: is to have it have some type of combination of a forearm connection and a vertical element to provide support.
So that's so that they don't have to use their as much finger strength to carry the
cane. Right. Yeah. And it's a lot. Like I said, it's a lot more compact than using a walker. He does have a walker, and but I think he prefers this because he does is pretty stable,
mm-hmm.
And it just lets him get around better. Yes.
So this appears to be mostly for balance support. He's using it more for balance than for uprightness?
Right. I think for him, he just needs a little bit of stability.
Mm-hmm.
He can balance pretty well, but, you know, he's not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So this will provide some of that insurance for him. But he doesn't, from the way he's walking here, you can see he's not putting a whole lot of weight on the canes.
He's standing upright.
Right.
Yeah. The walker is that it forces you to move forward.
That's right.
And this looks like he can actually be in his bones.
Right, exactly. So in summary, we've heard a lot of different projects here, and I think they're all great projects, Luke. There's a lot of interesting things to work on. There's a couple more things. There's a whole list of things from the VA, the spinal cord injury at the VA. I talked to a occupational therapist there, and those are listed in the handout, as well as a whole series of needs from folks with spinal cord injury. And if there's a lot of possibilities for working with people on these kinds of people, disabled veterans on small projects, even like gardening projects and other little things that they have. So if you want to work on that, you would go over there and talk to individuals and the OT there and come up with a good project idea and execute that. So, you know, we heard a couple of neat technologies, the NeuroSky technology and the Will Garage technology. So those are sort of things, technology looking for solutions. But we're actually trying to match, you know, people's needs and solutions. So the things that the folks in Webster House might need and the things that the folks at the VA might need might mesh with those technologies. And it's the idea to see if you can come, you know, match those up together and come up with a neat project. So I want to thank all the presenters for coming out and bearing with us through this long process. And so they're going to be around here, and they're willing to talk to you about ideas. And as you move forward with your projects, you want to be able to really dive down and figure out what the needs are. We're going to be talking to the people who suggested the project, as well as the people who might benefit from them. So if you have any questions, I'm here, they're here. I'd like to see all the people that weren't here on Tuesday, students that weren't here on Tuesday, because I want to meet you and I have handouts for you. And so I'm looking forward to seeing you, everybody, on Tuesday, and have a great weekend. Thanks a lot.